Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, longtime travel writer Pico Iyer, who has trekked to countries as far-ranging as North Korea and Ethiopia, is now making the case for mindfulness and stillness.
And in an age of distraction, nothing is so luxurious as paying attention. And in an age of constant movement, nothing is so urgent as sitting still.
And in an age of constant connectedness, Iyer writes that staying put and turning off your phone is an exciting prospect. It may be more necessary than ever. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Pico Iyer is one of the world's most celebrated travel writers and a novelist and the author of numerous books about crossing cultures. His work includes such books as Video Nights in Kathmandu, The Lady and the Monk, and The Global Soul. And since 1986, he's been an essayist with Time magazine and publishes regularly in The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's. His newest book is The Art of Stillness, Adventures in Going Nowhere. And he joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. Welcome back to Forum. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be back here.
Well, this is a book that really takes us into a whole new dimension that certainly hasn't been associated with you in your career, because you've been on the move all these many years, traveling everywhere. But really what you're making us think about is the importance not only of going nowhere, but of sitting still, of really directing ourselves more inward into maybe what T.S. Eliot called that still point in ourselves.
Maybe just because the external world is so overwhelming now and it's accelerated so much even in the last 20 years that stillness, which used to be a luxury almost, I think is now a necessity just to keep our sanity and our balance.
So the luxury isn't sitting still. It's Leonard Cohen plays an important role in this. I want to talk about that with you. But as he said, you know, you make yourself free of all this stuff that's going on inside and the stuff that you don't necessarily need. You get away from it.
Yeah, and find out what's important. I think many of us have this sensation now that 100 emails come in on us every hour, and some are trivial and some are essential, and it's harder and harder to tell one from the other, I think.
Well, and I suppose being still and being motionless, or as much as one can be motionless, is a way to come to grips with all of that, to understand that in a deeper way and understand perhaps yourself more ultimately.
Exactly. To process it and just to stand back from your life and the world long enough to find out where to go with it next. Because I think many people are getting dizzy now. You know, the World Health Organization has called stress the health epidemic of the 21st century. And even if we're not in a situation of stress, we are in a situation of information overload or data obesity, as they call it. So we need something just to get our health back.
Well, you mentioned, I mentioned Leonard Cohen, and he became an important figure in this, almost a catalyst for you in many ways. I want to talk about that. You kind of went up to the mountain, like Muhammad in the mountain, or Moses in the mountain. I mean, you went, instead of going to a desert where a lot of people get inspiration, you went up to the mountain and Leonard Cohen.
Yes, Moses is exactly the precedent to cite there. And yes, 20 years ago, I drove up into the high, cold, dark mountains behind Los Angeles, and I met this ragged figure in woolen cap and wire rim glasses who started cooking dinner for me. And it took me a while to appreciate that this was Leonard Cohen, who had already been famous for 30 years then as a singer and a poet and a worldly man, always surrounded by glamorous girls and dressed in a beautiful suit. But he had gone to live for 5.5 years as an ordained Zen monk. And I think one of the things that really impressed me was that this man, who has tasted all the pleasures of the world, everything that sex and drugs and rock and roll has to offer, came into my cabin late one night. And he said, the real deep entertainment in life is just sitting still, looking after these people, living a quiet life on the mountain. And he didn't only just say it, but I could see by watching him that being still had released a sense of kindness and attentiveness. It was really humbling. He had sort of erased the public entity known as Leonard Cohen and become this anonymous monk. And that was impressive to witness.
Well, he said he got free of confusion and terror, which you know, a lot of people would like to be free of. But there's also that argument. I remember years ago when I read Emerson, and Emerson said, you know, you take Ralph Waldo, that is, you take you wherever you go. And there's some truth to that, probably. You could attest to that more than most because you have gone so many places. But it, you know, there's a lot to be said for meeting new people and having new experiences and traveling, as opposed to staying still?
There is, but I think you can only make sense of those new people and experiences by sitting still. I think stillness is the second part of the traveling process in some ways. And the travel is how, as you say, you gather sights and stimulations and new ideas. But stillness is how you turn those into insights and into meaning. You take the experience and draw the meaning from it.
So I think we have a clip, actually, of you, Danny, do we have it handy, of you talking about the screen, the metaphor you just used, and the way of processing experiences. This is from a TED Talk. This is Pico Iyer.
I think many of us have the sensation that we're standing about 2 inches away from a huge screen. And it's noisy, and it's crowded, and it's changing with every second. And that screen is our lives. And it's only by stepping back and holding still that we can begin to see what the canvas means and to catch the larger picture.
And it's the larger picture that we should be after, I presume, in your judgment?
Yes. I mean, by the larger picture, of course, I mean many things, including what's important in life, which gets lost if we're racing from email to appointment to cell phone call, I think. It's alarming to hear my own voice. I've never heard that before.
I'll give you a virtual experience here. Nothing more exhilarating than going slow, you've said, and you say it in the book. And you even talk about it as, you use the metaphor of falling in love.
Yeah, because I think all of us are happiest when we're most deeply absorbed in something, when we forget the time, when we lose ourselves, when we're completely caught up in a conversation or an intimate encounter or a movie or a beautiful landscape. And I think most of us are scratchiest and least ourselves when we're racing around. So at some level, we all know that our contentment lies in being quiet and losing ourselves to what's around us. But as Emerson said, and as you said, we race around the world in search of what we have at home.
Yeah, you say, there's no place like home, right? We should have learned that from The Wizard of Oz. you say we're almost like sometimes emergency physicians permanently on call. And indeed, I feel that way a great deal of the time and feel the need to cut back. But sometimes I think when you go too far inward, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, you can get into a lot of your neuroses and your solipsistic tendencies and all of those things deeper than you want to be.
Yes, absolutely. It's just a matter of balance. So Thomas Merton, a great figure of inwardness, living as a monk for 28 years, when you read his journals, much of what you see is rage and impatience and restlessness. So you don't want to go too extreme. But I think right now we're living more externally than ever before. There was a young woman in Sacramento. They found she was handling 300,000 texts every month. In the time you and I are talking, the human race is going to gather 8 times more information than is in the whole Library of Congress. So I think just in the last 20 years, we've suddenly reached this point of getting more and more of the outside world coming in on us and less time even to see how little time we have. And so inwardness is more important now, I think, than in the year 1990 it would have been, when we had plenty of space in our lives already.
Pico Iyer is here with us in studio. His new book is called The Art of Stillness. And you mentioned Merton. There's even a little section in your book about, you know, his falling in love with a nurse. Is falling in love with with a nurse sort of like falling in love with stillness?
Well, I included that because, yes, a year before that happened, Merton finally retreated to a hermitage, even separate from his monastery, and he said, "Now I will marry the silence of the woods and the beauty of the world." And it sounded like a perfect thing for a monk to say. He fell ill. He had to go into the hospital. Instantly, he fell in love with this probably bewildered 20-year-old student nurse who didn't know what to do with a raging, lustful monk. But it's just a reminder, as you said, that there are certain things stillness doesn't prepare us for, and it's not all sweetness and light. A lot of it is tumult.
Isn't there a book out there, What to Do with a Raging Lustful Monk, or how to handle a raging lustful monk? Happiness is a word that we bandy about all too often. We're guaranteed, supposedly, in our republic, the right to pursue it and all that. I don't know that that's true for any other culture, but you're sense of being in a taxi cab and suddenly feeling, boy, I'm on top of the world. You know, I've got the job I love. I've got all the creature comforts, a job that's full of adventure and excitement. I've got a nice family, all these kinds of things. And then suddenly that boom, it's almost as if something of an epiphanous nature hit you and you thought, I got to get to Japan or got to get out of this.
Yes.
What can you describe that more for me, what you actually underwent?
So that was when I was in my late 20s, and I had the life I probably dreamed of as a little boy. I had this apartment on Park Avenue in New York City, 25th floor office, four blocks from Times Square, and what for me was a very exciting job, writing on World Affairs for Time magazine. Really interesting colleagues. So and no dependents. I could take my holidays in Bali and Morocco, El Salvador. So it was full of surface excitement. But I felt suddenly at one moment I couldn't separate the excitement from real contentment, or couldn't separate pleasure from joy. And I was having a terrific time, but was it really sustaining me or widening me or making me a deeper person? I felt not. So I bailed out of my dream life. And as you said, I moved to a single room on the back streets of Kyoto, Japan, where I had no private toilet, no telephone of my own, not even really a bed. And suddenly I found that the day opened up. And it seemed to last for 1,000 hours. It never had when I was living in New York City.
Anybody say to you, Pico, you're nuts, you're missing all the action?
One of my oldest friends from high school, soon after I arrived there, he sent me a postcard saying, sounds like you've gone crazy. Well done. And he was the wisest friend I have, I think. So, and what I also found, actually, was I could write much better in that stillness than I was able to in the midst of New York City. So even in terms of career prospects, I probably became more employable when I left the rat race than when I was in the thick of it.
But a writer has to be out of the rat race. I mean, you know,
exactly.
Solitude is a necessity. And you write about Proust, you know, and how Proust took in all that memory and then pretty much in the isolation and in the solitude and the stillness, perhaps, was able to create.
That's right. The writer's very lucky because we're paid. These days, maybe not paid, but we're at least encouraged to sit still as our job description. So you're right, that's an unusual thing. But sitting still in the middle of New York City and sitting still in the middle of Kyoto is something very, very different.
Well, you also mentioned Bartleby the Scrivener, that classic work of Herman Melville's. And I always, this is the American Lit scholar in me maybe, but, you know, always thought that that was a story of a man. And he just said, I would prefer not to. And wound up preferring not to do anything. Became really virtually paralytic almost, or catatonic by most standards. And it's almost in some ways a cautionary tale, because it seems like by doing nothing, he falls more and more into a kind of madness.
Yes, and becomes almost posthumous. It's almost like a response to Henry David Thoreau, who'd gone and sat still and done nothing 5 years before that. So yes, that's another extreme case. But what I noticed, because I travel a lot, as you say, is that 30 years ago, I would talk about going to Tibet or Cuba, and people's eyes would light up because they were hard places to get to. And now anybody listening to the show can access the remotest parts of Tibet or the most exciting parts of Cuba on their smartphone in their bathroom. But what they don't have, or what we don't have, is any space in our schedule to appreciate that. So now I notice when I talk about going nowhere, that's when people's eyes really light up, because we don't have enough chance just to do nothing.
Again, Pico Iyer is our guest. And by the way, he'll be speaking tomorrow night, 7:30, and holding day-long workshops on Saturday, starting at 10 a.m., both at Grace Cathedral here in San Francisco and both organized by the San Francisco Zen Center. A lot of what you're talking about obviously appeals to a Zen mentality or to a Buddhist mentality. Your father was a theology professor at Oxford?
Yes, both my parents were philosophers, and they were professors of comparative religion, essentially.
So how much of this comes into that early exposure?
Well, maybe my genes are kicking in at last.
Could be in your DNA, yeah.
It could be, yes. I mean, I was lucky to be exposed to a lot of this stuff as a kid. But it's interesting, as you said, these themes are essential to Zen practice. But what I'm finding now is that it's actually corporations and Silicon Valley people who are really interested in these themes more than Zen.
Because they look at Steve Jobs. I mean, these are old ideas. These are ideas that are ancient.
And, yes.
And one, you know, people constantly feel they want to go back and discover whatever can be discovered through those ancient ideas. And so a lot of this is discovery, I think. It has been for you, yes.
Rediscovery, that's right. And old ideas with a new relevance In other words, in the time of the Stoics or the Buddhas, they were all talking about the importance of getting perspective. But they weren't receiving 116 emails as they were writing that sentence. So now there's greater urgency, I think, than there used to be.
Well, it's why people have these internet Sabbaths. Yes. Kevin Kelly, for example, and Tiffany Schlein, and a lot of people come to mind who on the same program have talked about the importance of having an internet Sabbath. But let me go to something that's come across my vision recently, and that is an article about mindfulness that really was quite critical, a lot of pushback, and said this really isn't Buddhism. It's kind of separating mindfulness from what the integration of mindfulness should have been in all the Buddhist precepts, trying to put it kind of mutually exclusive from everything. It's become kind of an industry, you know, corporations learning about mindfulness. And mindfulness has a lot to do with compassion, has a lot to do with, you know, having a heart and all that. So what about that idea that, you know, we need to be more mindful of what mindfulness really is?
Wonderful point. Absolutely. I think I'm not a Buddhist, and I actually never use the word mindful in my book. But as I understand it, the core idea of Buddhism is motivation. So you're right. If you're just sitting still in order to advance in the world, you probably haven't advanced at all, even if you're sitting still. So I agree. What struck me with Leonard Cohen was the kindness that this had released in him and the humility and the attentiveness, not the fact that it helped his career. So absolutely, mindfulness has become a great fashion, and like any fashion, it can be abused as much as it's used. And it's interesting, you know, I deliberately wrote this book as somebody, I've never meditated, I have no spiritual practice, I'm not involved in any kind of mindfulness. I'm, as you said, a travel writer and a journalist. But even I, or maybe especially I in my job, find I need sanity just to function and just to tend to my loved ones. And so without meditating or practicing yoga or Tai Chi or anything, I just try to carve out spaces in my day when I can take a breath and clear my head and ensure I'm not lost under the deluge like, you know, Mickey Mouse in Fantasia or something. But you're right. Any mindfulness industry sounds like a contradiction in terms, as Emerson and Thoreau would have noticed, because it shouldn't be an industry. It should be a defection from industry. It should be more like Bartleby.
I met Leonard Cohen a long time ago, and he struck me as a kind man at the time. And I suppose you could go inward and discover kindness and decency and character and all those virtues that we hold in esteem. But it strikes me, I like Robert Bly. I don't want to give him a bad press here or anything along those lines. But, you know, they went out in the forest and discovered kind of atavistic things in themselves. That was that whole men's movement was about years ago. You could go inward and you could discover all kinds of things that are unpleasant too.
Yeah.
That maybe you don't necessarily need in your life, or you're better off repressing?
Yes, when you go into the wilderness, you'll meet as many devils as angels, for sure. But I think those dark places are not going to go away of their own accord or by our pretending they don't exist. And I think the best way and place to attend to them is when you're in a situation of clarity or calm. You know, if you're driving on the 280 in rush hour, that's probably not the best time and place to deal with your wounds and your frustrations and your rages. If you go into the forest or take a retreat or take a hike to Point Reyes seashore for 24 hours, that may be a more tonic way of dealing with it. So I regard this mostly as a matter of health, but mental health more as much as physical health, because that's at the core of our being. We all have that tangle inside ourselves we have to deal with, and it's hard to deal with anything if you're racing around.
It's also hard because there's so much machinery in our midst and so much technology. I mean, and it makes life a lot easier. It makes life a lot more comfortable and enhances life in many ways. But sometimes almost seems attractive to me to go the Luddite route, because I think about, for example, my mother hanging washing on the line. You know, this is sort of a strange metaphor that comes into my mind, because we didn't have a washing machine. We didn't have a dryer. So you had to go through washing them with a baseboard and all that sort of thing. I mean, it seems almost virtually antiquated, because in many ways it is by today's standards, but it's also a good metaphor for how far we've come and the time that had to go into concentrating on the wash and putting it on the lines to dry out and all of that sort of thing. No time for that now.
Well, unless you make the time, unless you choose to create the paradise wherever you happen to be. So I'm not a believer in Ludditism, but after I left New York City, for 23 years now, I've been living in a two-room apartment in Japan with my wife and kids. We have no car, so 100 things not to worry about. I've never used a cell phone, so 1,000 distractions not to think about every day. And I can take 2 walks every day, and they seem to bring me much more than watching the latest episodes of The Simpsons or turning on to TMZ or whatever the options might be. So, and I don't think I'm unusual. I'm guessing everybody listening to this program has found some way just to try to carve out some space in her life, whether it's by going for a run every morning or spending a long, slow hour cooking or doing some equivalent of your mother's washboard. I think instinctively people are feeling that they need that space or else they have no self to function anymore in the world.
And I think the key for you is this gives you happiness.
Yes, and health, I think. And it means I have much more to share with my wife and my kids and my mother and my bosses than I would if I was just breathless and exhausted and shouting at them, text, you know, see you later, or if I was just texting them.
But you're so unneurotic. I mean, you've got that advantage going for you.
If only.
No, but I mean, I think a lot of your temperament, your disposition lends itself to what you're advocating here. There are, you know, a lot of people who are in tumult a lot of the time and can't necessarily go where you're asking or suggesting they should go.
Well, if you'd seen me in 1986 when I was in New York, I'm sure I was much more wound up and agitated and racing around. And so if you're seeing anything in my temperament, that's the result of 28 years of living quite quietly away from the roar of things.
Quiet desperation has helped.
No, quiet non-desperation. That's what Thoreau was offering us, an escape from quiet desperation.
Yeah, remember, Thoreau also said, I want to eat a woodchuck raw. I mean, there was that whole side of him, too.
Yes, the Robert Bly side, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, we're going to get you, our listeners, involved in this discussion, which is, I believe, a fascinating one, and I know many of you have some thoughts about this. Do you find yourself more drawn to, well, simply being still and being without motion and keeping your life constantly in motion? And it also gets into some bigger questions about how we are gratified by the external as opposed to the internal, and where the lines ought to be drawn, and how much ought one to not necessarily retreat, but step back. Find moments of stillness and moments of contemplation and contemplativeness. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and let me tell you how you can participate in this discussion. You can call us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your calls. So feel free to join us by phone at 866-733-6786 or email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Love to hear from some of you who have had some experiences in this realm, who have gone perhaps into deeper places of nothingness. Of course, that can also evoke feelings of nihilism and get into the whole nature of what we mean by nothing. I think it was Democritus who said nothing is more important than nothing. You know? I'm getting some listener responses here that I want to just get on the record quickly before we go to break. Alyssa writes, to be the devil's advocate, why believe that grasping the actual big picture will make us happier? The big picture of the actual universe, unencumbered by our superstitions and distractions, will not see us happy and may well drive us mad. You're nodding your head, Pico.
So I would say that we need to understand things. We need to understand the people we care about. We need to understand ourselves. And not understanding is not a useful response. And that's, I think, what I mean by the big picture. Just not being caught up in the details, but seeing what's really going on.
And that is a wonderfully pithy response. Thank you for that. We will hear from more of you, our listeners, when we return. We're spending this hour with Pico Iyer, and his book is The Art of Stillness. His past books include Video Night at Kathmandu, In Kathmandu, Lady and the Monk, and he's been an essayist for Time magazine since 1986 and regularly writes for Harper and the New York Times. And once again, he'll be speaking tomorrow night, 7:30, and holding a day-long workshop on Sunday, 10 a.m., both events at Grace Cathedral. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Pico Iyer, and his new book is called The Art of Stillness. And let me correct something. He is speaking tomorrow night at 7:30 and holding a day-long workshop on Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. That's Saturday, not Sunday. And both events are at Grace Cathedral, organized by the San Francisco Zen Center, and tickets are available online. And here's a listener who says, poor Leonard Cohen, he's now been appropriated even by the New Agers.
Can I say something?
Yeah, of
Which
course.
Is, to me, Leonard Cohen is the voice of old age. He's a voice of ancestral wisdom, the Old Testament, and the great old tradition of Zen meditation. So I think he would have no time for the New Age. And he may have been appropriated by them, but anything good is appropriated by them. That's probably not his fault.
So. This is from Igor. I think there may be a subtext in Igor's email, though. Like, you know, we're talking woo-woo stuff here, or this is
yes.
out there on the fringes, or, you know...
So actually, one of the things that most impressed me when I visited Leonard Cohen in the mountain was all he'd been doing for 5.5 years, as he had it, was scrubbing floors and shoveling snow and emptying his teacher's bedpan and driving his teacher to the doctor. So really down-to-earth stuff.
Service. A lot of it service and labor.
And yeah. hard work, yeah. And the opposite of anything wishy-washy. I was the one bringing my wishy-washy ideas about what Zen is, and he was quick to correct me. It's about hard work.
Noel writes, I hope the younger generation, those who are hooked on constant connection on their screens, will read your book, but will they put aside the time to read a book? Another listener, Clifford, writes, if Pico Iyer is not familiar with the practice, I'd like to invite him to attend a Quaker meeting, a 360-year-old continuing Western practice in the art of sitting still, listening, and serving. There are active meetings in San Francisco, Palo Alto, and Berkeley, as well as many other locations. And indeed, the Quakers do have a long tradition of this, looking for the inner light and
yes.
being contemplative. There's also a contemplative tradition in Christianity and other religions, lest we put too much emphasis on Buddhism, which by many people's lights is not even a religion, but more, for many people, it's a form of practice and meditation and all the things we're talking about here. What do you think? You think Buddhism is a religion?
No, I don't. I think it's a training of the mind. It's like a gymnasium of sorts for dealing with emotions. And I must say the place that has really opened my eyes and mind to this practice is a Benedictine hermitage where I've been staying for many of the last 24 years. And they're just as contemplative as their Buddhist cohorts would be. In response to the question about the kids, I'm not worried about our kids, because I think they will find their own balance in time, the way we did with cars and TV and everything that seemed so exciting when I was 15. And soon I found that the car was taking me into traffic jam and the TV was giving me a headache and I turned off. And I'm sure I'm more worried about people of my generation who sometimes are too excited by the new and forget to put it in an older context. I love the Quaker tradition, incidentally. And I mean, the beauty of this idea is it's ecumenical. It's like an oil change. And every religious tradition has this at its core.
Did growing up in Oxford shape a lot of what you're thinking now? such a quiet, wonderful, pastoral place.
Well, so you probably say that as somebody from California. For me, growing up in Oxford made me want to flee to California as quickly as possible. But, I mean, it's wonderful. It's got all those medieval cloisters, which have their own beauty. But in those days, the Grateful Dead seemed more exciting to me than the medieval ages.
Well, the Grateful Dead could be pretty contemplative, too.
They could.
Certainly Jerry Garcia. let's get our callers on. Scott, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to suggest that mindfulness is more of a symptom that of awareness and really of self-awareness. We're either self-aware or we're not self-aware to varying degrees. And I also wanted to suggest that technology, more specifically smartphones that we interface with daily, we create patterns of behavior on our smartphones and habits even, that will one day eventually feed it back to us and make us more aware of how we spend our day, sitting, standing, walking, texting, emailing, all of these infinite number of possibilities. It collects the data on us, and it can also feed it back to us just to simply make us aware of our unconscious, making the unconscious conscious. So I want to suggest that while technology may be the trap, it can also be turned into a tool as part of our an extension of our consciousness. Does that make sense? Am I making any sense there?
I think one of the most popular apps nowadays is Headspace, which is all about everything we're talking about. So exactly right. Technology is neither good or bad. It's up to us how we choose to make use of it. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think we're living in an age of weapons of mass distraction, if you want. And so the greatest luxury of all becomes attention, which is really what you were saying. Awareness is another way of saying just attending to the world around us and attending to how we can best respond to it. So, yes, I think I'm happy to leave the word mindfulness out of the discussion.
Well, actually, it's more, and thank you for the call, Scott. Good to hear from you. We'll go to more calls in a moment. But I guess more to do, it seems to me, with thought. I mean, you even mentioned Hamlet a number of times, and nothing is true except thought doth make it so.
Yeah.
And it has to do with how we cogitate.
Yes. Which is the wisdom of the Stoics. Again, it goes back 2,500 years when they told us it's not our experience that forms us, but how we respond to it. So my house burnt down in Santa Barbara a few years ago and 1,000 other people's houses burnt down. And some people were devastated by the loss and some people were liberated by it. And so it wasn't the forest fire that really is determining the course of their lives. It's how each person chose to think about it. William James has that great quote, the only response to stress is to choose one thought over another. So yes, I love your bringing the word thought into it because that's where it all lies. And if we're thoughtless or if we're completely mindless, then we're at the mercy of events. We need to bring something back to them.
I did an event a number of years ago with Jack Kornfield and Pema Chodron, names you probably know and certainly many of our listeners know, two leading Buddhists. And the electricity went off, and people were supposed to have certain seats assigned to them, specific seats, and everything was messed up. The computer went on the fritz, as we used to say. I don't know where that even came from. They both thought it was a wonderful teaching moment, you know, because you could have been overwrought and stressed by it and everything else. But just to, of course, the danger with that, it can be a wonderful attitude, but the danger with it is you can sort of fall into passivity sometimes and not do anything. Because there are people, for example, who can act under stress with life-saving and, you know, life-positive kinds of things, of course. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think what
action.
I think
not stillness, but action. Yeah.
Yes. And of course, Jack has that wonderful book title, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, which is, again, a reminder that it's wonderful to have these great experiences. But what really is important is, as you said, what you do in the world after them.
We'll get some more calls. Suzanne, join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for the interesting conversation and your work, Mr. Iyer. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
I just wanted to give a plug for mindfulness found through The Pedestrian. I consider myself a poster child for being overly connected, but I find that very simple activities outdoors, for example, berry picking in Northern California, can center us in ways with great benefit and perhaps with less intention, but still great benefit. I think for some people, the idea of actively pursuing meditation or other contemplative practice religion can be a turnoff or seem like another thing to do on a long list of do. But simply getting outside and connecting with nature through a hike, or I go to berry picking simply because it really does focus you. If you don't want to be pricked by all the thorns, you have to actually really focus on choosing the right berries and doing so mindfully. It's another way that we can have that same benefit of presence.
Thank you. Well, you've made my day because that's really what my book is about. As I said, I'm writing as somebody, I have no spiritual practice, I've never meditated, I don't know anything about mindfulness. But I think even those of us who aren't interested in that direction can, as you say, pick berries, go for a walk, take a hike this afternoon, cook, go for a run. In other words, there are myriad ways of coming to that same place. And thank you for reminding us of that.
And thank you for the call, Suzanne. You've traveled so much of this globe. Any cultures that particularly speak to, I mean, one thinks of India, of course, almost immediately, but in your experience, where the people seem to be living a contemplative life or much more drawn to that kind of life of stillness that you're talking about?
Well, I chose Kyoto as the place to move from New York City because it's for 800 years it's been premised on sitting still. There are 2,000 temples in the hills around it. And I think anyone who's been to Japan will notice a certain quiet and a self-containment and an attentiveness, especially. People there are very good at listening and they're very good at trying to figure out other people's needs. That is really humbling and is one of the things I wanted to learn by going there. Places like Tibet and Iceland have and Wyoming, for that matter, have the benefit of huge amounts of space that open up space inside us. But I think, as Emerson said, you know, travel is a fool's paradise if you think you'll find anything on the far side of the world you didn't find at home, as you quoted earlier. So the beauty of all this is it's right here. If you're on Market Street this afternoon, I think there's a potential to find that stillness.
The book, again, is The Art of Stillness. Early on, you bring in Emily Dickinson. Let's talk about her role in all this.
Yes, well, because she's an example of what we were saying with Thomas Merton, too. There she was in her room pretty much uninterruptedly for 27 years. Some of the time light and epiphany was visiting, sometimes terror and death was. So again, it's not all about sweetness. But there was a real courage in Emily Dickinson choosing to travel the world while staying at home and to deal with the most essential stuff just by sitting still in that tiny space which I once visited in Amherst and having these immensities come in on her. And it's hard to read her poems without shivering because you can feel those winds sweeping through her little chamber.
I remember a friend of mine, Maurice Basson, once saying, you can learn all you need to know from reading Emily Dickinson. There is some truth to that.
Yes.
Here's Brian who tweets, can we only perform stillness alone? Can we bring loved ones or significant others into the forest and reach the same perspective?
So I was back in my Benedictine hermitage 2 weeks ago, and I took my wife, and we stayed in adjoining rooms, and every now and then we would share our silence, and we found the silences we shared were probably richer and more communicative than the words we usually share. And, of course, community is a large part of this, too. And I think when I went to Leonard Cohen on the mountain, a lot of what he was saying was that being still allowed him to tend to everybody around him, as maybe he wouldn't have done so easily if he was just sitting in his isolated house in the middle of Los Angeles. So, yes, I think, you know, before I went to see him and before I went to a monastery, I thought that stillness was about moving away from the world and about moving away from humanity. And then after I saw him and after I did it a bit, I felt it's actually about coming closer to humanity. And actually, when you sit still, you quickly start thinking about the people you really care about in a way that you maybe don't think about them when you're racing around too much. So I think it's a way of coming closer to humanity. I remember when I first moved to Kyoto, I talked to an abbot of a big temple, and he said, well, the whole point of meditation is not the going away from the world, it's the coming back to it. And I think that's an important thing to remember, too, if you're using stillness as a way to boost your profit, your profits. It's probably not going to work in the right way.
I wondered, both Leonard Cohen and Peter Coyote, who lives here in the Bay Area and is a rather famous actor, were born Jewish. They both become monks, Zen monks.
Yeah.
Always wondered about that connection. I mean, people would talk about bagel Buddhists and there's all this sort of thing, but, you know, it's fascinating to realize that, and these are both famous people who, as you said, had everything they could have wanted in terms of materialism and what life seems to offer in the ways of pleasures, but made that choice.
And you know, as you know, Leonard Cohen maintains a very serious Jewish practice to this day, and he refers to himself as a Jew, and he says, I don't need another religion. I'm not a Buddhist. I've got this wonderful millennia-old tradition already here. And most of his songs are still about Solomon and Abraham and David and the classic. And I think part of the power of Leonard Cohen is to bring sort of Babylon and Tinseltown together. In other words, he's drawing from these great Jewish stories, but he's positioning them in the heart of Hollywood and Malibu and Samsara. And that's something that not many people are doing.
Great line of Oscar Levent's, I don't know if you know it, about Tinseltown.
Yes.
He said, underneath the tinsel, there's more tinsel. Another online comment is, Mr. Iyer ever feel angry, depressed, or lonely about constantly being surrounded by people who generally seem too busy to sit, relax, and enjoy life the way he envisions?
No, I because most of the people I meet are probably more interested in these ideas than I am. And so, no, I think that's the least of my problems.
Let me read one more email here, sort of in your corner. Jean writes, when I was in college decades ago, I attended a seven-day silent retreat sponsored by the Quakers. We were a group of 15 who ate, worked, and played without speaking. It was a divine and life-altering experience. Since then, I have regularly meditated, make sure I carve out quiet time for myself every day. It's made all the difference, and I encourage everyone to cultivate a daily stillness routine. Well, instead of multitasking and carving out time to be still, there are some people who think, well, I got to carve out time to take a nap. Is that a way of being still?
Yes. And I sometimes think if I just spend 30 minutes every day sitting quietly, that's only 3% of my waking time, but it will transform the other 97%. And I sometimes think that, for example, when my doctor said to me, you need to go to the health club every day and do 30 minutes on the treadmill, I religiously signed up and I go every day. But when somebody says, as in that wonderful message, just be quiet for 30 minutes, I'll say, I don't have time. But the being quiet is much more essential to my well-being and the well-being of everybody around me than the treadmill. I think we've lost a sense of cause and effect sometimes.
And we go next to you, Robin. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I'm calling because I wanted to share that I had a really bad accident a couple of years ago, and I sustained a brain injury. And I would never wish that on anyone, but it really informed me. I found some gems in the rubble in that it takes you back to zero. Like, everything has to be quiet. There can't be a lot of light. There can't be a lot of noise. There isn't a lot of busy, and even reading is a very busy thing to do. I found that sitting out in the spa by where the chimes are, which I always loved, it was fine if there was just a soft breeze, but then if the breeze kicked up a little bit, my brain would go, keeping track of that is too much work. So in the recovery process, I was able to see just how busy we are. I had been very busy in my life before this happened, and there was a voice in the back of my head saying, I love my life, but I can't keep doing this. And it's almost as if some part of me was saying, well, okay, watch this. And it brought me to such stillness that I will never be able to do what I used to do, handle that much busyness. And that's a blessing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. Actually, when I published this book, The Art of Stillness, one of the first and most enthusiastic letters I received was from a 17-year-old young woman who said, I really relate to what you're writing about because I just got a terrible diagnosis and I have to spend all my time in bed. And she said more or less what you said. And it was humbling to me because I'm in a lucky position of choosing stillness. But it was amazing. She saw it as a wake-up call, which I think is how you described your terrible challenge.
And Robin, thank you for that description. Appreciate hearing from you. And next we'll hear from Stefan. Or is it Stefan?
Yes, Stefan.
Okay, Stefan, welcome.
Ohayo gozaimasu. Piko sama. Genki desu ka?
Genki desu yo. Arigato.
You know, really, I'm actually on a layover from Jamaica to Japan. We share a couple of things in common. I live in Japan too. I'm your neighbor, 45 minutes away, Nishinomiya, on the Shinkansen.
Sugoi.
And I wanted to say that, you know, as an atheist, non-spiritual, non-meditative ADHD adult, I've pretty much been living your lifestyle for quite a while, ever since I moved to Japan from California in 2014. But I didn't know that it had a term. There was a term attached to it. You know, it just helps my ADHD. I mean, I have to, you know, I learned the term from Alvin Toffler, overchoice, some years ago when I met him. He was one of my mentors. And I realized very early that I just cannot, I don't have the tolerance for a lot of this information and this data obesity. So I have to shut that down. And so I have to minimalize the things, the stimuli that I allow to come through. So, you know, I'm glad that there is a name attached to it. I thought that I was strange in my life choices, but...
Isn't it great, Stefan, when you find you can define what you didn't have a name for? You've actually got nomenclature now?
Yes, yes.
Okay. We thank you for the call.
I think maybe the name is the least important thing. You were doing it without the name, and that's just as good. But, you know, one of the things I'll just say, and I love that phrase, overchoice. And when I travel and I go to North Korea or Iran or Tibet, I realize that people in those countries desperately need more freedom, more choice, more movement, and more information. So their worlds are being made infinitely better and richer by technology. It's just the handful of us in places like California who perhaps are ODing on this.
Let me read some more emails. This is from Hema, who says, I think each person has to find his or her own way of calming down. I find peace in cooking and find the sizzling, boiling, and stirring sounds very soothing. Dan from Grass Valley writes, perhaps stillness, solitude, meditation, withdrawing from the world is not the best formula for creativity. Shakespeare lived in the busiest city in the world, ran several businesses, owned a troupe of actors, built and ran a theater. There's an old saying, I wanted to be nearer God, so I climbed the highest steeple. There I heard a voice that said, go down, I dwell among the people. Fair enough. Alejandra says, being of the younger generation, 21 years of age, I grew up in a family of immigrants of Mexico and slowly was introduced to technology. Yet I appreciate the aid in smartphones and technology. Yes, I have a Twitter account and a Tumblr account, but that doesn't define myself or my generation. I personally love time to myself and stepping away from the stress of the world more than being in constant motion. Here's Rick from Walnut Creek who says, thank you for having Mr. Iyer on the show. He mentioned running in the morning. I used to get up early and sit in the Zen way. I now get up at 5 and go running in the dark alone. Seems to be energizing and calming at the same time. And thanks for another great show. Thank you for that. Another listener wants to know if you've heard or are familiar with Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, and his attempt to separate religion and spirituality.
Yes, yes.
Comments?
Yes, you know, he's very interesting as he's taking the sort of Buddhist aspect of atheism or non-theism as far as it will go. And it's true. As I say, I think the people who practice mindfulness say this has nothing to do with Buddhism. It's just something to
do with
common sense.
It's almost become a platitude, people saying, I'm religious, but I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, you know.
Yes, and I think that's dangerous. I'm not eager to say that. I like the comment about Shakespeare, but I would also add that the reason we're talking about Shakespeare 500 years on is not his businesses, his houses, and what he was doing in the streets, but the time he was spending alone, presumably sitting still, scribbling those amazing works.
Here's Barbara, who says, while chastising the awareness industry, you are charging $100 for limited income tickets for your workshops this weekend. Is that this not a contradiction?
Well, it's not that money is not coming to me, and it's not I that is charging it, but that's a very, very good question. I know when I travel with the Dalai Lama, he asks the organizer of the event at the end of the event to stand on stage and break down all the economy of it and explain why the tickets are costing so much just to make sure that it's actually going to a good cause and where it's meant to be. And I think that's a wonderful practice.
Well, you write in your book about the Dalai Lama, about being with him in Zurich. And can you give us some of your reflections and thoughts about him? And...
Well, it's hard. I wrote a whole book on him, The Open Road, and I spent 40 years traveling with him. But initially, I thought that one reason he's so attentive and kind and has such a sharp memory is that he meditates for 6 hours a day. But then one day he told me, you know, I'm addicted. And I thought, what could the Dalai Lama be addicted to? And it turns out he's addicted to the BBC World Service. And while he's doing his 4 hours initially of meditation from 3:30 to 7:30 every morning, he's listening to the day's news. And I think that's an important reminder that speaks to many of the messages we've been getting, which is that meditation isn't about turning away from the real world, but actually embracing it and seeing what's going on. And it's not it's not about emptying the mind, but sharpening the mind. And it's not about unworldliness, but actually dealing with the here and now. And so with his meditation, following the news as closely as he does is really the heart of his practice. Whenever I go into his room at 8:30 in the morning, the main thing I see there is a newspaper. And the other thing I see there is a telescope.
I'm afraid I have the addiction to news, too. But since we're mentioning addiction just for the moment here, I had occasion to interview Nora Volkoff recently on stage. I don't know if you know her from the NIH. She's in charge of drug policy. She's sort of the overseer of problems related to addiction and research that the NIH does with addiction. And she had a lot of contact with the Dalai Lama as well. And, you know, mindfulness itself, or what is being called mindfulness or meditation, can be addictions.
Yes, yes.
Sitting and just being calm the way you're talking about can be an addiction.
Yeah. That's right. So there's nothing inherently good in the practice. It depends what we're bringing to it and what our motivation is.
And we'll bring more callers on. Kiki, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much. I love your show. So I have a couple questions. One's, what's his favorite books or the persons admire you like a soulfully? I don't use the word mindful. More likely I would rather use the word soulfully.
You want to know what really his favorite book is on this topic or related to what we're talking about?
Pico? No, because I believe that people, what he thinks is who he is. So I'm really curious to find out what impacted him to
you know, to chose the style he has right now.
Okay, fair enough question.
Well, this isn't the book that first influenced me, but I think San Francisco's own book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is a wonderful thing. And sometimes my editors in New York City going through real crises in their lives, and I don't know what kind of medicine to give them. And I usually will give them a copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Suzuki Roshi,
the word soulful is beautiful. I agree. That's a much more liberating word than mindful.
And thank you for the call, Kiki. And here's Robert, who writes, how do you suggest this approach for someone whose partner is tech-addled and does everything in their life to not be aware of how to achieve the stillness, though they may want it?
To do something to clear your head and then see how your partner is looking at you with new admiration and delight and suddenly thinks, I want what you're having, and what you're having is some minutes every day of being quiet.
We should mention that Pico Iyer is known for his writing, his essays, his travel writing particularly, not necessarily in the field of psychoanalyzing or prescribing mental health. But here's a listener named Stephen who writes, I suffer from depression and find keeping busy and focused helps to combat depression. However, I take time every evening to be quiet and still to reflect and think. Can you comment on stillness for those who have depression?
Thank you, Stephen. I actually describe that in my book as an example of how unchosen stillness can be like imprisonment and can be really difficult and a cycle that's hard to break. And I so appreciate your sharing with that. And I'm glad that you even perhaps though you're having more stillness in your life than you would like, that you can still do that 30 minutes and give it a positive inflection. But as Michael said, I'm not the person to offer informed advice.
Well, you've offered certainly a good deal of enlightened advice here in the course of this hour. And are you still doing travel writing, or are you just finding your way more and more to the stillness?
Well, they go hand in hand, but next month I'll be in Las Vegas, Mongolia, and Okinawa. So, yeah, I probably still do a bit of traveling.
And again, let me remind listeners that Pico Iyer will be speaking tomorrow night at 7:30 and holding a day-long workshop on Saturday, starting at 10 a.m., both events at Grace Cathedral, both events organized by the San Francisco Zen Center. So good to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can indeed continue this conversation online by going to kqed.org/forum. And we remind you that we certainly welcome your thoughts about what you hear on forum or would like to hear. You can email them to us, forum@kqed.org. I'll be back with you if all goes according to plan on Monday. Joshua Johnson will be with you tomorrow. And Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. And senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.